This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon, I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll find out more about Art House in Gary. It's a creative community, a space where food and culture and art and skill building all come together. We'll talk with Arlene Peterson, who's the current director at Art House, about it. And also during the program today, a conversation with Liz Theodoros. She is the volunteer recruitment coordinator for the Lake County CASA program. CASA, by the way, stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocate. We'll find out more about the CASA program and why volunteers are needed to help work with the program. About 2.5 years ago, it was really just an idea. Well, today, ideas have turned into a venue where artists and Northwest Indiana residents can all come together for what has been described as some progressive opportunities to collaborate. We're talking about Art House, which was the first program here in Northwest Indiana to start receiving funding through the grant series called the City's Challenge grant series created by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Perhaps you recall when we had a chance to talk with Theaster Gates, the Chicago brains behind Art House, and talking about his vision for what he'd like to see this project look like. That was back in the time when Theaster Gates and his supporters were among the finalists for that very first a Night City's Challenge grant, which, of course, they have received, and they have grown like crazy ever since then, in the last 2 years. We have in the studio to talk about the project Arlene Peterson. She's the current director of Art House in Gary. Arlene, thank you very much for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, Chris, thank you so very much. Glad to be here.
Take some time, if you will, to start things off and give us a little history lesson. We've kind of got things started looking back at the start of the Art House project. Where did Theaster Gates come up with his vision for what he wanted to see that in turn turned out to be the recipient of that very first City's Challenge grant and where we are today?
I think some of the great vision that Theaster brought to the table, also the synergy and energy of Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson, those two individuals coming together and really thinking differently about what can we do to help reignite and make Gary a place where folks want to continue to come, where businesses can begin to thrive, and you start to bring a bit of the local flavor and local feel for what's going to happen in the community. And the opportunities of the Night City Challenges came about, which was really about how can we create an incubator type program that's going to support economic development in the city. Along with that was the Bloomberg Philanthropies Public Art Challenge, was how can we, you know, infuse money into a community and help them do something that they probably wouldn't think to maybe pay for or have the money or funding to do something different, which the Public Art Challenge, which really was a part of that. Hence the birth of Art House, a Social Kitchen. It's truly a place for culture, art, food, and we even say fun for the community to come together. It's a gathering place. It's a place where you can taste different kind of foods that may be happening with different vendors in the community. It really is a place to showcase art in a various forms that could be happening in the community. And so it really is this incredible idea of food, art, coming together and using a space to create kind of public art pieces that are displayed not only on the outside of the building, but on the inside of the building.
Now, the building itself is very impressive, especially at night with the lighting that's set up out there. I have not seen it personally, but I have seen photos of what it looks like at night. And when you go to our website, when you check out Regionally Speaking podcast later, you'll see a picture, the daytime picture, unfortunately, of what the Art House looks like. The nighttime picture is just as impressive, if not more so, because it's a building that will capture the imagination. You can think all kinds of things about that building just by driving by at night when the lights are all on. The idea for the building itself is obviously it's a combination of services. It's the art gallery, it's the culinary incubator, which is something that's very important in its own right. And you say that's kind of been able to help grow over the last couple of years or so. And then this community meeting space. It's in an unusual spot at least for any other meeting space other than sports events. And the reason I say that is because it's right across the street on 5th Street from the U.S. Steel Yard, which is, of course, where the Railcats play baseball. So you see this big baseball stadium on one side and see this little very flashy-looking building, almost like made out of aluminum foil, on the other side of the street. When the designs were put together to create this building, did they have that in mind to have some facility that would contrast with the brickiness and the starkness of the baseball stadium?
Oh, absolutely. I think it was this idea of there are tons of people that are coming to Railcat Stadium, participating in games and enjoying their time there. What else can we continue to keep to attract and keep them there? And so when I first started with the program, you would see people come to the baseball games and they would walk on by. Now when they come to the games, they actually stop, they look, they're taking pictures. And again, it's that infusion of this public art piece, these lanterns. They're solar lanterns. They light up when the sun is shining really bright, and in the evening time, they'll light up at nighttime. They really create such a twinkle and a sparkle to, I think, the downtown area, and it just draws people's attention into what the space is.
Arlene, take us through the components of the entire project, starting out first with the culinary program, since we seem to know it first, and it's become predominantly that of this culinary incubator, which is only a very small part of this entire culinary program. Tell us about that.
Oh, so what they wanted to do, the Culinary Business Incubator Program, is really designed to work with individuals who have that culinary artistic ability to be able to cook food. They may have a really great product that maybe they've been cooking out of their home, but really want to expand and grow their product development. So the Culinary Business Incubator Program, which our first class, which was in March of this year, we had 24 participants who came, you know, on Saturdays, 4 hours worth of classroom training and instruction. We're supported by Food Hero Program, Arts and Public Life with the University of Chicago, just learning about what does it take to take what may be my idea around culinary art and actually really hone in the business aspects of it. They use business model canvassing as a kind of core component to the training to really kind of teach people, you know, how can you take that business plan, which may be this written document, but really to visualize how did that affect your customers? How did it affect the products that you have? So we had 24 absolutely incredible individuals who came out and have really kind of grown and developed in terms of their business abilities. Prime example would be California Jones, a group, individual, husband and wife team, have a catering business. They came in, took the Culinary Business Incubator class. We then were able to partner with them and a local youth program, City Life Center there in Gary, Indiana. And during the summer, we're able to provide breakfast and lunch, hot breakfast and hot lunches every day during the summer time for these individuals. So this allowed California Jones, which is a new business really starting out, to be able to come in and utilize this full commercial kitchen, which there's over 3,000 square feet of commercial kitchen space available for a culinary artist to come in and be able to kind of, again, work on the product and help them to mass produce the product that they're working with. And to be able to see that in action is truly, I think, the power of what Art House has to available to a budding culinary entrepreneur.
Are they finding, and did they find when they went through their courses set up there at the Culinary Incubator, that there's quite a difference between having a great idea and then crafting a business plan so you can turn that great idea into a business and then actually following through and getting to work with actual equipment? Or maybe before you might have just kind of tinkered around in the kitchen with an idea and you've got to push it that next extra step to make it actually an idea that is saleable.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it really it helps them to really think about the type of products. You know, maybe they had a menu that had 10 items on it. No, we're going to actually change it to 5 because they've really figured out how to maybe mass produce or take those 5 items and really make them their signature products. And so that's been one of the great things about seeing the evolution of coming in, taking classes, but now you're really honing on your business, honing on your customers, and being able to really identify how can I make myself unique. And then eventually, the goal is always that they start in that culinary kitchen there at Art House, and eventually maybe they get a food truck, and then maybe eventually they get a brick and mortar. Again, being able to establish some of that economic development that's needed there in the city.
Now tell us, Arlene, where the social kitchen fits into all of this. Now, we've talked about the culinary incubator, so we get people that are interested in taking an idea for a great culinary idea and turning it into an actual business, or seeing certainly through the process whether it's going to work or not. Where does the social kitchen fit into things now?
It comes in as now we have a place for people to gather, and when we can gather around food, that makes it even better. And so we have programs in our culinary and arts exploration program. These are programs that are culinary based, or they could be art based, and we host them there at Art House free of charge, invite the entire public to come out and participate in those programs, and it really becomes this social place where folks can come and gather, talk, meet, and greet. So we've had programs from a senior seasons blues show where we had a blues show just for senior citizens in the community. We had a cupcake wars where it was about families coming out and battling and tasting different kind of cupcakes that we've had. We've had a meal prep series where we had a young woman with Enjoy Eats come in and really talk about how do you help families to prepare healthy meals in the busy times that we have. We've had J-Rock's Gourmet Popcorn, a 12-year-old entrepreneur coming in and talking about what does it take for me as a 12-year-old to create a business around food and being able to teach that skill to other people in the community. So we've had more than 60 different culinary and art exploration programs since November of last year that have been there at the Art House in our social kitchen area.
Wow.
And we've had more than 1,000 individuals that have come into the building and participated in one of those programs. So that right there is that catalyst of what Art House is in terms of bringing culture, art, and food and people to gather socially and to get to know who your neighbors are and what's happening in the community.
When the idea of Art House was created, obviously you've got the kitchen idea, which was something that was very important because the city of Gary had the opportunity to, I think, here to turn something into a good opportunity to create businesses, which the city needs and still mm-hmm. always will need, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But then you've got this art gallery concept too. There aren't many ideas that kind of blossom into putting food and art together into one facility here. What kind of response have you gotten with just the art gallery alone now?
With just the art gallery, I think we are really exploring a lot more opportunities around the art. There are tons of people who have photographs of the city of Gary and its heyday. There are visual artists who are out there, young people who are artists in the local schools. We're really trying to bring those folks into the fold to really start to showcase them. And probably one of our up-and-coming events that we're having is our Gospel Mosaic, where we're going to bring in local artists to come in and do some painting. And during that time of painting, we'll also bring in artists to perform gospel music, but a variety from a quartet to a choir to an individual, but to really be able to feature a variety of different folks. Again, it's that bringing together of all these kind of different kind of people and individuals and displays of art, but having a place and a venue for that to happen there in the city of Gary.
In the last 2.5 years since Theaster Gates' vision for Art House blossomed into the request to create the application for the grant from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, that in turn, of course, led to receiving the first City of Gary Cities Challenges grant. What kind of recognition or at least interest have you gotten from outside Gary about this particular project? And that I understand that some of that interest comes not only in other communities interested in it, but also the media, too.
I definitely think we've had some interest out of Indianapolis with Centric Innovations doing some business workshops there we have at Art House. We've worked very wonderfully with Work One, the City of Gary, and employment opportunities. Currently, right now at Art House, we have an incredible retail fundamentals class that's happening with individuals in the community to teach them about the retail trade and get training and certification in that particular area. A lot of interest from just across the board, Chicago, all over the place, that want to come in and be able to provide additional workshops or supports to really help the community to grow.
And I understand one of the most recent articles that's come out online, and I guess it's in a trade magazine. It's called Curbed. It's a magazine that's put out for urban planners. And it's a national magazine, but the idea is that they like to look at different projects all across the country. The City of Gary was prominently displayed in one of the recent online articles, not only about the City of Gary's problems and how they've come through working them out, but also too talking about Art House. How does Art House fit into all of this from Curb's standpoint?
I think with Art House, we are one of those catalysts in terms of when you're thinking about planning for a city or planning for development in a city, you have to think about public art and think about it in a different kind of way as a draw to bring people into the community. You have to think about culinary arts and how are you going to, you know, when people come, they want to be able to eat. And so how are you going to make sure that you have a variety of places and venues and food options for folks that want to come into your community. And I really think Art House has just been one of those catalysts. There are probably at least three new restaurants in the City of Gary that are now very popular and people know that they can come and participate in those places there. So it's been amazing to just see this new venue and this new space really blossom, and we're just one part of all the things that can and should be happening in the City of Gary.
Now, if anybody would like to know more about Art House, what's the website address so people can check it out and find out more about, especially if they want to be involved in either the Culinary Incubator or some of the other programs?
It is arthousegary.com. Again, arthousegary.com.
Arlene Peterson is the current director of Art House, it's better known as Art House, the Social Kitchen, but it's more than that, much more than that, located on 5th Street, right across from Railcats Baseball Diamond in Gary. And Arlene, thank you very much for being with us to talk about Art House, and we're looking forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Thank you. We want people to come out, take a look, come see the art.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Northwest Indiana casinos won't be the only ones affected by the opening of a new Pottawatomie Indian-owned casino near South Bend. Indiana Gaming Insight editor and publisher and creator Ed Feigenbaum was with us here on Regionally Speaking to talk about the impact of the last Pottawatomie casino that opened up north and how all of Indiana gaming operations are likely to feel the pain from the newest one.
In August of 2007, the Pokagon Band of Pottawatomie Indians opened their Four Winds Casino in New Buffalo, you know, just a hop, skip, and a jump from Blue Chip Casino in Michigan City. And even though Blue Chip had done everything that they felt that they could to insulate itself from the onset of competition there, you know, they built that new hotel and added some other ancillary facilities, upgraded their own casino, so they immediately saw about a 30% long-term decrease in activity at the Michigan City Casino as a result of the Pokagon's opening this nice new facility nearby. And the other casinos in Indiana, and Blue Chip in particular, are going to be hurting from the opening of the new Pokagon Casino in South Bend next spring.
When you talk about a revenue stream being so tenuous, we obviously figure that it's because not only of the economy and people have to have extra money at their disposal to be able to go to the boats or to go to the casino if it's inland, but it's more, much, much more than that. There's a revenue stream that affects the entire economic cycle, I guess, within a community, doesn't it? It just goes beyond the casino itself, doesn't it?
Right. You've got jobs at each casino, you know, perhaps 1,000 or more jobs at any given property that, you know, are generally filled by people from the local community. You've got those people spending their payroll in those local communities, and then you've got the tax dollars that come in to the communities and the host counties, and you've got the money that goes to the state to pay for state needs. And you are not going to see that kind of money, with the exception of perhaps a local payroll from the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi Indians in South Bend, because they're not going to be paying any kind of state or local taxes. They're going to be making a payment of 2% of their net revenues to the city of South Bend, but nothing to St. Joseph County and nothing to the state of Indiana. They are not taxed by the state of Indiana on any of their gaming income. And the state has no control over their gaming activities in South Bend. And at the same time, the Michigan City Casino, as are all of the other casinos in the state, are taxed basically at a marginal rate of about 33-34% on their wagering income, and then they also will have to pay admissions taxes on each patron through next July, and then that kind of gets tucked into the wagering tax. And they have to pay all their old regular state and local sales taxes. The Pokagons are not subject to the same kinds of taxation, and they've got some other advantages. They can open up restaurants and gas stations and other facilities like that and have tax advantages over the other local businesses. So that's a reason for people to come and visit. And if the Blue Chip Casino, for example, has to be taxed on money that they spend on their promotional activities, their free coin or free play or what you may want to call that, the Pokagons don't. So they've got a better ability to market themselves cheaper. And make no mistake about it, they know this market and they are great operators. You know, they have done a tremendous job with the casino in New Buffalo, and they have built up a tremendous local customer list. You know, they know everybody who might be ready to gamble in the new casino from Ohio to Illinois, and they're going to be targeting those people.
Now, Ed, do you think that we may see some concessions from the Potawatomi tribe that could, in turn, if things go well, produce more income? That'll come back in turn. You mentioned the fact that St. Joseph County isn't going to get any share of the revenues from the casino, and the state of Indiana is not be able to get very much, I'm sure. Do you think there may be some changes that the Governor Eric Holcomb and the lawmakers might see to?
Well, the Pokagons are going to open with what's called Class 2 gaming right now. And that won't be really noticeable to the patron, with the exception of the fact that they would not have live table games. But they will have slot-like machines, and they'll basically be indiscernible from the regular slot machines that you see at the commercial casinos to the average patron. Now, the Pokagons will probably be doing this because they want to show the state that they don't need the state's help, or they don't need anything from the state, and they shouldn't have to make any concessions in order to get something from the state. But if they can negotiate from a position of power and say, okay, well, in order to get live table games, we'll give you, you know, this particular amount of income or whatever, they can do that if they can show that they're bringing in just a really tremendous income stream and hurting the other casinos and hurting state revenue as a result. Now, but the state's going to have to make concessions in order to get anything from them. You know, the state may have to say, okay, well, if we allow internet wagering, we'll prohibit the commercial casinos from doing it, but you can do it. Or we won't locate any kind of other commercial casino or VGT operation or OTB or whatever within, you know, 100 miles of you. There are all kinds of things that the Pokagons could be looking for in something like that. And the state has retained a law firm from Michigan that's very experienced in Indian gaming law and in compact negotiation, just kind of advised the governor's office on what they can do, what to watch for, and what they should do.
We're talking, pardon me, we're talking with Ed Feigenbaum, who is the editor and publisher of Indiana Gaming Insights newsletter about the Potawatomi Indian casino that is being built in the South Bend area and the impact it's going to have on all of the gaming operations in Indiana, especially here in Northwest Indiana, being so close here. What kind of fears do you have, looking at all of this, that the communities that currently have casinos in in the poor counties and as well as in Lake County, what we're going to face in trying to deal with this threat?
Well, the biggest thing is the loss of tax income and the potential loss of jobs at the existing casinos. You know, this is a tremendous boon for the city of South Bend in particular. You know, they're getting some money in. They're getting a lot of new jobs. They're already getting the benefit of all the construction jobs and the booster effect there in the community from that. And it will be an extreme positive for the city of South Bend, but it comes at the expense of their neighbors.
I understand, too, that other Indian tribes besides the Potawatomi Indians are very interested, of course, in getting casino operations that they haven't had before. And I guess there's even the Miami Nation in Indiana, which is based in Peru, as well as in other states that are going to try to get land together for a casino. Do you think that there may be some other states that might want to join with Indiana, perhaps, in trying to find ways to deal with this or at least be prepared for what they're going to face?
Yeah, that's going to be a tough road to hoe, but it'd also be difficult for some of these other tribes to find themselves the kind of land that they need in Indiana under the law to be able to do something like this. And this isn't really new. You know, we've seen this going back to really 1994, mm-hmm. when the casinos had been authorized in 1993, and Gary had the first two shots at the table there, and we're supposed to be able to get a casino going in Gary before any other casino, but they had difficulty in trying to assemble the right land for it, and the mayor and the casino companies, Trump and Majestic Star, didn't quite see eye to eye, and the mayor ended up getting a contact from the Miami tribe of Oklahoma to try and put a casino in Gary, saying, oh, well, we've got something we can kind of claim as tribal lands there. And then the Miami Nation, Miami Tribe of Oklahoma, also tried a couple of years later to put something in Vigo County and actually West Terre Haute, saying that they had ancient tribal land there as well. But the problem is that you have to have, particularly under the way the federal law works now, you have to have your own tribal land, reservation land in a particular state. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs, particularly the Trump administration, is not going to look too kindly on granting the authority of a tribe to open a casino on something outside of its ancestral tribal land. Yeah. Yeah, that was a little bit easier under the Obama administration, but you know, this president in particular has had experience with opposing Native American gaming in the state of New York, where it potentially bumped up against his commercial casinos in New Jersey and some plans that he had at the time for expanding gaming under the Trump label in upstate New York. So it's not going to be an easy task for any tribe to come in at this point and get approval for gaming in Indiana beyond the Pokagon.
Indiana Gaming Insight editor and publisher Ed Feigenbaum. There's a program that is underway here in Lake County that runs with the aegis of the Lake Superior Court Juvenile Division. It's called the CASA, which is the abbreviation for Court-Appointed Special Advocate. And we have with us today from the Lake County CASA program, Liz Theodoros. She is a volunteer recruitment coordinator, and she is hopefully will give us an insight into more about the program, how it fits in with the juvenile court system in particular here in Lake County, as well as why volunteer help is so important for this program. Liz, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
First, if you will, for folks who are not familiar with the CASA program in general, what is it and why is it so important for young people who are kind of caught in the morass of the legal system? For whatever reason that it happens to be, I guess.
Well, Chris, the CASA program was started in 1987 here in Lake County. There are CASA programs throughout the state and the country. We are child advocates, and in the state of Indiana, we are appointed by law or by statute to mm-hmm. represent the best interest of abused and neglected children.
When you look at this idea of having somebody who is a certainly an advocate, somebody who speaks up for the children, it's very important that they have somebody, some grown-up especially, to be able to do this. It has to be terribly intimidating for a young person to come in for whatever reason into the court system, and it's like you feel like a tiny little person with these huge grown-ups around you, and a lot of gobbledygook is being spoken, and especially if you end up in a court proceeding of some type, and they probably have no idea why they're there.
Right. And so our volunteers, they represent children in these matters of child abuse and neglect. And so we represent newborn children all the way up to 18. And so these children, through no fault of their own, find themselves as wards of the state. And this process is one of providing services to these children and their families who face many problems. Poverty, domestic violence, there's physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, there's educational neglect, medical neglect, all the things that you read about or hear about in the media. These are the issues that these families are and children are dealing with. And so a volunteer takes a case, and they are charged with visiting the child on a regular basis about once a month, and then they attend hearings about every 3 months. And nothing is done for these children unless it's court ordered. Mm-hmm. And so the Department of Child Services, they're the folks that provide the services for the children and the families to help them heal and to remedy the situation as to why the case came in to begin with. And so it's a process of gathering information. How is the child doing in their placement? They may be in foster care. So the volunteer would visit the child in their foster home, gather information about how the child is doing in that placement, how are they doing with services. And then we attend, as a staff member, we attend a hearing with the volunteer and provide fact-based information to the court and to a judge who is going to make orders for the child.
Do the volunteers, because they're in contact with the child and with the family members on these particular cases, are they kind of a conduit of information to the DCS? Although the DCS has caseworkers, of course, they're going to be taking care of the matter too, but do they offer more information maybe than what the DCS can handle? Because a caseworker has so many individual cases that one particular person has to handle. They can't possibly know everything, and they certainly can't find out everything right away.
Absolutely, and as CASA, we definitely collaborate with the Department of Child Services. And so we exchange information, and we get that information into the courtroom. And so our volunteers gather information. They share information with the Department of Child Services. There's a family case manager for every child abuse case, child neglect case that comes in. And so the Department of Child Services, they're a legal party to these cases. CASA, we're a legal party to the case, and the parent is a legal party to the case.
How does Senior Judge Thomas Stefaniak, who is the judge in Lake Superior Court Juvenile Division that is overseeing all of this, how does he fit into this as far as CASA is concerned? And how does he feel about having all these volunteers helping out to do some work that certainly he couldn't or even his own court staff couldn't handle?
Sure. Well, Judge Stefaniak, he presides over the very first hearings in this abuse and neglect process. And so he hears the very first cases. They're called detention hearings. And they're scheduled every Tuesday and Thursday afternoons at 1 o'clock. I do attend those hearings as a CASA representative in the courtroom because it's at these very first hearings is when he appoints CASA to the case. And to these matters. So we have many, many cases that come in every single week. And we're really seeing an uptick right now because now, of course, schools are back in session. And so schools, teachers are reporting. So our numbers we do see an increase mm-hmm. in child abuse and neglect reports.
We're talking with Liz Theodoros, who is the volunteer recruitment coordinator for the Lake County CASA program. And the reason we've asked her to come in to talk about the program is because we're about to go into another of the series of volunteer training sessions for people that want to be involved and want to help young people out for all the problems they may have to help give them this advocacy role in the community as well, too. How long have the volunteer training programs been going underway? Probably ever since or before the CASA program got started, I would imagine.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, in 1987, the CASA program was started in Lake County, and we serve abused and neglected children all throughout our county. And so our training gives a very good overview of child welfare in Lake County. We do two trainings a year. Our next volunteer training session begins next Tuesday, September 19th. There is an application process and an interview process, which I am conducting interviews right now, this week. And so the training consists of 30 hours. We break that into 10 evenings, 6:15 to 8:30, Tuesday, Thursday evenings. Volunteers are given a manual. That's theirs for their reference. There's 10 chapters that covers child welfare issues and some of the legal process and some we give them some courtroom observation and so we really prepare them to be able to finish the training and take a case. They're sworn in at the very end of the training as an officer of the juvenile court. They take an oath of confidentiality and then they begin their casework. They come in to our office, they work with a staff member, a case coordinator, and select a case, whatever case feels right for them. Mm-hmm.
What kind of person seems to work best as a volunteer in the CASA program? That may be a very simple question. And for a very, very complex answer, there are lots of different people that want to be involved, but who would likes to be involved and become a court-appointed advocate?
Well, no, that's really a great question because this is a very specialized field. Mm-hmm. And so in my experience, I've been on staff for 17 years, and I've been recruiting and screening and training volunteers for that period of time. And a person that works best in these cases as a volunteer is someone that has a heart for children. However, we really appreciate someone who is a good communicator and also someone that does not have a problem with the emotionality of this work. And so while it is emotional work, we really emphasize that, you know, you can't be very emotional because it compromises your ability to advocate objectively.
That sounds like you have to have somebody who has, a good head on their shoulders.
Absolutely.
Because you have to be impartial, but you have to be and compassionate, but you also have to be sure that you're aware of what's going on and keep everything in context that they happen to hear and see, I would imagine.
Definitely. Absolutely. And so, you know, someone who's very resourceful and can find some answers for these children when there are no apparent answers sometimes.
Now, you mentioned you're going through the process of getting ready to select the next series of volunteers, but you're obviously looking for volunteers, as you say, a couple times a year is when the volunteer training program is underway. If
yes.
anybody is interested, they're not maybe involved in this class coming up, so to speak, but maybe ones in the future, how can they find out more and who should they contact?
Okay, they can contact myself. My phone number at my office, at my desk, 219-660-6978. And I have an email that's quite easy. It's lakecountycasa@gmail.com, all one word.
That's great. Liz Theodoros is the volunteer recruitment coordinator for the Lake County CASA program, which is administered out of the Lake County Superior Court Juvenile Division. And Judge Thomas Stefaniak is the senior judge of the courts, and he is the fellow who is in charge of these cases that come up before him as a juvenile matter. And he, in turn, has been able to endorse and continue working on a program all these years, and that probably has made a lot of people very happy. And hopefully you've seen some successful cases has come out of all of this, I would imagine.
Absolutely. The happiest, most joyful cases are the adoption cases. Mm-hmm. And so once a year, Judge Stefaniak puts together an adoption day. And so all the magistrates and Department of Child Services and CASA and the court staff at Juvenile, we all come together and oh gosh, we've done anywhere from 40 to 50 adoptions on that particular day, and we have a service, a comfort dog, at Juvenile Moxie, and she partakes also.
Liz Theodoros, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate you coming in, talking about the CASA program and this great program to get volunteers involved all across Lake County.
Thank you so much, Chris, for having me.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Northwest Indiana woman who lost her son to suicide is helping organize two local walks this month that will benefit the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Mary Edwards was with us here on Regionally Speaking to talk about the organization and how it seemed to help her deal with a very, very personal loss.
AFSP, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, is a wonderful organization that is dedicated to increasing the understanding and preventing of suicide through their research, their education, and their advocacy. In order to do that, they need money to increase those efforts. And when almost 12 years ago, in fact, in October, it'll be 12 years, my husband and I received a phone call that we had lost our son to carbon monoxide poisoning. He was 19 years old. We just didn't feel like we had anywhere we could turn at the time. And the most important thing to us was to take care of ourselves. And then we started to realize that we had to do something to stop this. We had to stop it, especially for young people. And that seems to be where we seem to be the most interested. And when I looked at just in their name, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, I was impressed, and I wanted to dig deeper in how we can really affect everyone around us by a better understanding and preventing of suicide. And the prevention is what I'm all about. And I jumped on the bandwagon just completely because I could see that there was a definite need. And the walks that the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention sponsors, like the one at Wicker Memorial Park, is their way of bringing us together, those who have lost somebody to suicide, where we can discuss and share our stories and also raise awareness and raise funds for their mission, the mission of AFSP, to decrease or increase the understanding and prevent suicide in the future.
Mary, tell us, if you will, about the experience, a sad experience that you and your husband had about your family members, and what kind of relationship mood disorders played in trying to deal with the tragedy, not only a personal tragedy, a family tragedy, but it's turned into, I guess, a national tragedy as well in dealing with suicide.
Well, you're definitely right. Suicide is the fourth leading cause of death for adults between the ages of 15 and 64 years in the United States. So there's definitely a problem here that we have to address. And a person dies from suicide every 12 minutes in the United States. And that's scary because it's, when we lost our mark, it was at 16 minutes. And so it's not getting better. And AFSP is working really hard to change that. I believe their efforts are to reduce the amount of suicides by 20% by 2025, and that's really a big deal. If we can come close to that, just by increasing awareness and using our funds to bring out education and to increase education on it and research, the research is really important at this point.
Are we finding, and you've found too in your work and not only the organization but your own personal look into the problems that seem to be behind suicide? And we've talked here about, you know, educating people about mood disorders. It's not all, you know, the kind of mood that a person happens to be in that can prompt them to take their own life, but it certainly seems to play a rather large role, does it not?
You might be referring to is the fact that mental illness is a problem that we in the United States must learn to face and figure out how to help those people with mental illness. Mm-hmm. It's not any different than if you found out you were diabetic. And we have to find ways to make people feel, who are concerned about their own well-being as far as their mental health. They need to feel comfortable and to be able to go to a doctor and find help and assistance. And we don't have that at this time.
We're talking with Mary Edwards, who is a spokesperson on behalf of the upcoming Northwest Indiana Out of the Darkness Community Walk, which is going to happen on September 30th. It'll be from 10 o'clock in the morning till 1 in the afternoon at Wicker Memorial Park, which is, of course, located on Ridge Road and at Indianapolis Boulevard. It's in the community of Highland and Munster as well. The people that are involved in the walk are, I guess, of all basically walks of life, aren't they? It's not people necessarily who have necessarily lost someone to suicide, but people who have family members who have had contact with others that have had ones passing because of the suicide, because of suicide and just the other issues that they come about here. I guess what I'm trying to find, do we find that there are many people that are involved in the walks? They need to tell people, they need to support the efforts to educate people about this very, very serious problem.
And absolutely. And of course, you know, just the word suicide is a word that we don't like to use very often. And even the idea that people are depressed and depression among the people. I mean, over 50% of all people who die by suicide suffer from some major depression. So I guess what it means to me is if these people knew they could turn to someone, and by bringing this to the forefront, the idea of suicide and mental illness at AFSP Walk, we're able to get these people to find help and realize that they shouldn't feel bad because we've had such a bad idea behind suicide. I mean, they just shouldn't be out there like that.
That's Mary Edwards, who, along with her husband, is a personal survivor of a family suicide. The two Out of the Darkness Awareness Walks are coming up here in Northwest Indiana. The first, September 16th in Chesterton, and then September 30th at Wicker Park in Highland. New regulations for how big farms manage to handle raw produce won't affect the hundreds of vendors that sell at Indiana farmers markets, but small-scale growers will have plenty of rules they're going to have to follow. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek has this look at how Hoosier farmers markets try to keep their food safe for consumers to eat.
This is ground beef, and then like...
Graham Ryder digs through a freezer stuffed with plastic packages of frozen meat. His family owns Thistle Buyer Farm in Burnettsville, and he's in their trailer at the Lafayette Farmers Market.
Here's your thermometer. Oh, that's good. It's below 20.
That thermometer is one way his family keeps their food up to code at this market. They follow state rules, mostly common sense stuff, says Ryder, like basic labeling, keeping frozen foods cold enough, and washing and sorting raw produce. All that is enforced by the Tippecanoe County Health Department. Along with a full load of other restaurants and stores, they say they inspect each local farmer's market twice a season. Ryder says it's usually a surprise visit.
They just do, like, you know, the checklist of, like, things they're looking for. So, I mean, honestly, we probably get some demerits on dirty floor, but...
That little things like that, though.
Yeah, right? Well, they'll, like, let's just go through, like, okay, so just general cleanliness and stuff like that.
Most Hoosier farms are like Thistle Buyer. They don't sell enough or over a large enough area to qualify for the strictest standards on things like raw produce. Purdue University food scientist Amanda Deering estimates only 60 or 70 farms out of about 2,000 in Indiana will have to comply with the latest version of those rules under the Food Safety Modernization Act.
So these are the growers who are shipping multi-state. They're growing, you know, a variety of different commodities. You know, it's our large cantaloupe growers, watermelon growers, and then others that are producing other fruits and vegetables.
In the next few years, she says, the big growers of anything meant to be eaten raw will have to meet new standards for training and storage, for how they use and test water and soil, and, here's the big one, for writing it all down.
I mean, a lot of it isn't new to them, especially the big guys that are going to be covered by the produce rule. But just keeping all these records, I think, is going to be one of the harder things.
And one of the costlier. Deering says that's why the new rule doesn't apply to small growers.
That's one thing that will never go away, is that people can always buy direct from the farmer. And the farmer's market is just a way to facilitate that direct-to-consumer sale.
How are you guys today?
Good. Gary Cox runs Trinity Acres Farm in Darlington and sells produce at the Lafayette Market from May to October. The harvest of early August is spread across his table.
Swiss chard, eggplant, basil, green beans, zucchini, bell peppers,
He says he learned how to handle his produce properly through hearsay and can't remember ever being inspected. He says he's not even sure who makes the rules, but he knows what they are.
We go out and harvest, and then it's washed and packed within the hour, and then we refrigerate it, most of it.
Cox says that's the advantage for consumers at a farmer's market.
They're going to get it fresher. The less it's handled, the fresher it's going to be.
Nearby, Sharon Morphew carefully selects some of those fresh potatoes for a cookout tonight. She says she doesn't think much about how this produce was handled.
I wash them when I get home, so I'm not worried.
Traditional farmers markets like Lafayette's probably won't face other regulatory changes soon. With the new federal rules in place for big growers, state reforms are focused on other kinds of agribusiness, namely wineries and breweries. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek in Lafayette.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, it's Thursday, Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and with us, we'll have Greg Tejeda, as well as Carrie Napoleon and Meredith Calais from the Post-Tribune, and Carmen McCollum from the Times of Northwest Indiana.